Well, this hour, we're going to take your phone calls and continue talking with Matt Stein about when technology fails and also when disaster strikes. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Matt Stein with us. Matt, what is the pit of the stomach exercise you talk about?
Well, that could really save your life. This is, see, when things are crazy in the world and things are falling apart.
As they are now.
I'm talking a lot worse than now. But right. Now is a good time to start practicing the pit of the stomach. See, I believe that Mother Nature bred the most incredible survival mechanism into each and every one of us. There's like this inner compass that can, in a split second, can make life and death decisions with a high degree of accuracy and guide us in the right direction when we don't have enough information to make a good rational choice. And see, those people who didn't have that in their DNA, well, they got eaten by the saber-toothed tigers, or they died in the battlefield, or they got popped in the pot by the neighboring tribe, or whatever. So basically, that DNA is in each and every one of us. But in our modern world, we're so focused on the rational mind and on running things through our computer in our head that we ignore this intuitive side. Now, there's a lot of very successful businessmen and entrepreneurs who have that intuitive edge and rely on that gut feel to make critical decisions because they found through practice that it really works.
Yes, it does.
So the pit of the stomach is a simple exercise that all of us can do that can help guide us in that time. And I like to use a real-life example of a real-life tragic situation as a teaching example for the pit of the stomach. So now imagine, this is a real-life example. The James Kim was a media personality in TV shows in the Bay Area. And he and his wife and two small children spent the weekend in Seattle, and they drove up. And they were driving back down Highway 5 through Oregon on their way back to California. And it was late at night, and they were talking, and they didn't realize they'd passed their exit. They were going to take a cutoff to the coast and stay in a city on the coast of Oregon called Gold Beach. So they looked on the map, and they determined that it was going to be like 4 in the morning before they got there if they turned around and went back to the cutover. But they saw on the map that there was a cut through the mountains on a smaller road, and they decided to take that. Well, it was a very dark and stormy night. And they headed up the mountains, and the snow turned to rain, and they got off on tiny little roads, and they were scared they were going to make a wrong turn. They thought, okay, this is too scary. We're just going to park, and in the morning we'll get up and figure out where we are, and we'll just spend the night in the car. Well, I woke up in the morning, and the car was snowbound in 2 feet of snow, and they were two-wheel drive, and there was no cars around, no other tracks, and they were out of cell phone range, and they didn't know what to do. So they spent a couple of days there, and the kids were freezing. They ran out of food. They ran out of gas in the car trying to stay warm. Oh. He took his tires off in desperation and burned them, and then it was like, okay, what am I going to do? Now, so this is where the intuitive edge is so important, the pit of the stomach, because you don't have enough information at your fingertips to make a good rational choice. So what you would do in this situation or in any situation where you're struggling, like you can't trust your mind when it's changing its mind every minute. Like maybe I should do this, and then 30 seconds later, oh, maybe I should do that. And then 5 minutes later, oh, maybe I should do this. So when your mind is flip-flopping, you're in trouble. So and if it's a critical decision, then you want to make the right decision. Okay, so here's the pit of the stomach. What you're going to do is you're going to be thinking in pictures. And you're going to be using body feelings to tell you whether it's a good or bad decision. You're going to be avoiding rational linear thought because you don't have enough information to make a good choice using rational linear thought. So in the James Kim situation then, he'd say, okay, I don't know what to do. And so if you're spiritual, you pray and you ask God, Jesus, Buddha, the Great Spirit, Holy Spirit, whatever you want to ask, whatever you believe in, you pray and ask for help. Now, if you're not spiritual, well, a lot of people get that spiritual all of a sudden when they're in a dangerous situation. Or you just say, please help me generically, or you just ask for guidance and inspiration, whatever. So you take some really deep breaths to quiet the mind until your thoughts quiet down, and you focus your concentration on the area between your your belly button and your rib cage. That's the pit of the stomach. The Chinese call it the Dan Tien. It's an energy center. So you keep breathing and focusing your energy on the feelings there until you can feel it relax. So if you're in a really tense situation, it may take some while, and you know, you may have to do this for a bit to get it to quiet down. Now you make a picture. You're going to do this in pictures, not linear thought. So James Kim, okay, the first picture you might do is the rational mind says, well, there's a survival rule, which is always just a guideline and not a real rule, of follow the river and it'll take you to civilization. So they were near a creek, so that's one thing. So he would just picture himself hiking down the creek, and then you feel that stomach, and you feel the reaction. If you feel the stomach tense into a knot, bad choice. If you feel a queasy, yucky, sort of nauseous feeling, bad choice. If you feel a relaxed, feeling, then that's a good choice. So maybe James pictured this going down the river and gets like a really knot and says, oh, that's what I thought I should do, but my stomach is telling me it's a really bad choice. So then he does some breathing and maybe some more prayer until he feels it relax, and then he makes another picture. Like, maybe I should hike up on the ridge. Maybe there will be like a helicopter, you know, looking for me. Maybe I'll see another road and, you know, like a smokestack from a house in the distance that I can go to or something. So he pictures himself hiking up on the ridge. And then if he feels like a bad choice, and it's like, wow, what should I do? Then maybe he pictures himself staying in the car. Now, the rational mind would scream at you and say, that's the sissy way. You're all going to die. You know, you stayed in the car, and nobody's come along, and you're freezing, and you're running out of food. So you can't just stay in the car. But, okay, so let's get back to James Kim and what he did. Well, he chose to go down the river, which is what the rational mind would say is a good choice, that you follow the river of civilization. He had tennis shoes, he got wet, he got cold. He was found 2 days later, face down, a half a mile above a hunting cabin. If he'd known he was only a half a mile from civilization, then he could have gotten in and got food and a phone, he would have made it. But he didn't. He died of exposure. Well, what happened to the family? Well, when he didn't show up in Gold Beach, his parents got really concerned, and his dad put out alerts, and they started people searching. And he got people to track the cell phone records, and by the pings off of cell phone towers, they isolated the general area where he was, and people went out like on four-wheel drives and you know, dirt bikes and different things out in there, and somebody followed their tracks and found the car. So the wife and kids were cold and a little hypothermic and very hungry, but, you know, they were okay.
They were rescued by a helicopter pilot,
well,
right?
I think, you know, but basically some lady on like a quad vehicle found them, I think.
And their cell phone, and we should say the cell phone didn't work, but the pings were picked up.
The pings got people close enough to find them eventually, and so they were rescued. So if the pit of the stomach had been used, perhaps he would have realized that, you know, the choice that seemed like the worst choice, which was seemed like doing nothing and the wrong thing, was actually the right thing
that
to do.
That was the right
just
thing
to
do.
Stay with the family.
Just wait it out.
So this is something that is so important. And I have used this technique for decades when I'm struggling with decisions and just can't figure it out with my head. I've used it. And in fact, when I took my job out of college, that's just like, I mean, 1978, I was struggling because I had three top choices, and I just couldn't decide between the three. And the least favorite of the three was taking a job at Hewlett-Packard in Palo Alto. Well, I prayed on it and felt the stomach, and it showed very clearly I had to take the last of my top three choices was the best choice to take. And it turned out that my future wife worked across the street from me, and her dad worked in the building next to me, and there was no way I was going to not meet her. But how would I know that at that point in time? I mean, there's no way of rationally knowing it. It was the least interesting of the three jobs and the least appealing. But when I prayed and did the pit of the stomach exercise, it clearly told me I had to take that job.
Let's take some calls for you. Let's go to Daniel in Wichita, Kansas to get us started. Hey, Daniel, go ahead.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I want to respectfully disagree with your guest.
Sure, that's all right. Go ahead.
And I'll tell him why. When you're talking about a job, your pit of your stomach is a lot different than when you're starving to death, or you're freezing to death, or you're burning up, and you have no help, you have no electricity. I called you in March and told you that I had done an experiment because partially listening to your show, partially because I knew things were going to hell, and I went without anything for 3 days.
On purpose?
Yes.
Okay.
And now I went for 8 days, and I told you I'd call you back.
Yep.
The biggest thing I found, other than I couldn't deal with security, and I know that's a big, big issue, but I didn't have people, hordes of people coming to my property. But what I've done is I have a 50 by 120-foot garden now, and I'm canning all kinds of stuff. And I can tell you this, when you make a decision like he's talking about a job or something else, that is not the same as freezing to death or starving to death.
I think, Matt, you understand that.
Well, I understand, and I'm not saying not to prepare. I'm saying that when you're struggling, often, perhaps, and best to practice now when it's not life and death, I'm saying that Mother Nature has built into your spiritual DNA this mechanism, an inner guidance system that can see around corners, that can guide you to make the right decision when you simply do not have the information at your fingertips. I'm not saying don't prepare. I'm not saying don't stock up food. I'm not saying don't learn how to farm. I'm not saying don't learn how to forage. I'm saying in my book, When Technology Fails, I show people a huge variety of things. I help you prepare. I teach you the best of modern technology and the best of old-fashioned technology. So if things totally fall apart, then rather than sliding back to caveman days, if things fall apart, I teach you the old technologies of like 200 years ago. I'd much rather fall back to 18th century technologies than caveman days. Because when in my grandmother's day, in each town in America, someone could make, grow, or fabricate everything necessary for a reasonable standard of living in a reasonable life. And so and people have forgotten how to do that. So I researched and put together in my book how to do that. So I took the best of modern technologies, things you can buy and get today while the world's still working well, as well as the technologies of 200 years ago and 100 years ago that most people have forgotten, you know, how to tan leather, how to make soap, how to build a fire from scratch, you know, how to do a fire drill, how to foraging for edible foods, the edible food test, how to do solar water disinfection, which is a modern technique, you know, scavenge. Like if things fall apart, you go to the dumpster and dumpster dive and pull out water bottles and then put them in the sun. In 6 hours in the sun, in bright daylight sun, the UV rays will sterilize those bottles. And in 2 days, in overcast, it will clean the bottles. And if it's raining, we'll collect rainwater because you won't get enough sun to sterilize the bottles. But I teach you the best of all of those things. But I also know that in a crisis situation, you're going to be faced with making decisions and not having the information. You won't have CNN. You won't have the Internet. If you have to leave where you are and go somewhere else, how do you make that decision? That inner guidance system can help you make that life and death decision and make the right decision with a high degree of accuracy, and that could save your life. So I'm not telling you don't prepare. I'm telling you have as many tools at your fingertip as you possibly can and be as ready as you can for that day, and hopefully you're going to help not just yourself but your family and your friends and your community by doing that.
How do you feel, Matt, about protection, about having a gun?
I'm not a gun nut, but I feel that it is a necessary evil in this time and in the coming times. I mean, not necessarily today.
I'm not sure it's an evil.
Somewhere.
I'm not sure it's an evil.
Well, I'm not saying an evil. I'm just saying having a gun both so that you can hunt with it and you can offer protection and there's trade and barter. I mean, there's nothing that's not good about it except if you're not careful and don't store it properly and there's a tragedy because some, you know, kid slips in and you know, or it's used in anger sometime and there's a tragedy. So I'm saying I feel that guns and ammunition are very positive things to store so long as you store them properly and so that they're protected from a tragedy happening. In other words, if you want something to save life and a life is lost as a tragedy because of it, then that's a tragedy. And I'm saying do the right thing. And, you know, people think that hunting is going to save them. But I want to talk about that some. Because I'm not saying that not have a gun, but I'm saying placing your confidence just in the gun is false confidence.
But here's my point. If the grid goes down and it's down for a year, let's say, A year.
That's a long time.
Which is a long time, and it's conservative. You're going to have a lot of people upset. They're going to try to break into your house. They're going to do all kinds of things. When people have their backs against the wall, they will act in a different way.
I agree. And I believe there's safety in numbers, because the lone wolf will be, who's well-stocked and well-armed, will be picked off by people who have better, you know, have a lot of buddies and can, and won't be, and will be up a long time and will take you down.
Yeah.
So I believe that guns and ammunition are great, and networks and community are great, because when things go down, think medieval times, think communities, think castles. There's strength in numbers. So what you're going to need, and if you don't have all the skills and all the stuff, you need to team up with a network, because not everyone, not one person knows everything. Not one person has eyes in the back and can stay awake 24/7. So in a community, you can share. Now, maybe you're older and you have some guns and ammo, but you don't have the physical strength. So you team up with other people who may be younger, have the physical robustness and the ability to use them, but maybe don't have the money to store these kinds of things. So, and maybe you're younger, or maybe you don't have any money, but you have skills. So what you do is you develop your skills and develop your stores and supplies in within your means and capability, and you accommodate. If you're weak in one area, then you try to be strong in other areas, so you can at least pool your resources with other people. So thinking about hunting and guns, I'm not saying not to have them, but I'm just saying you need to think broader. You need to have a bigger picture. Because I grew up in Vermont, and I grew up hunting and fishing. And everyone wants to go hunting on the first day of hunting season, because that's when all the game is plentiful and they're not too smart. And I talk in front of thousands of people, and I ask people to raise their hands, like, how many people had a really good day hunting in the last day of hunting season? And so far I've had like one woman and one man raise their hands. Now think in a long-term collapse situation. You're talking the last day of hunting season 100 times worse. So think about foraging. When the Soviet Union went down, Cuba and North Korea depended on the Soviet Union totally for all of their medical supplies, their gas, their oil, their spare parts. Well, in North Korea, without the Soviet Union, if you weren't a part of the military and the government, you were SOL. You were out of luck. You were starving. And 5 or so million people starved that winter. And every rat and mouse and squirrel and bunny rabbit were gone. Grass is pulled up to boil the roots to eat. Bark was stripped off of trees.
People panicked.
People didn't panic. People died. It wasn't panic. It was survival. There was no food. If you weren't part of the government system, you didn't get anything. So think about that. Now, when... I once shared a radio show with a guy, I think it might have been Cody Lundin, but I didn't know who Cody Lundin was in those days. He's a guy from Arizona who had a survival school that did taught primitive living survival skills. And he said at the end of his, you know, week-long teaching primitive living skills, the men and the women would split up into groups and go out and be in the wilderness, and they couldn't bring fish hooks, they couldn't bring guns, they couldn't bring knives. They had the clothes in their back, and they had to do everything Native American primitive style. So the men typically focused on hunting and fishing, because that's the manly guy thing. And the women focused on foraging for edible fruits, nuts, tubers, berries, things like that. Well, come day three, almost invariably, the women would take pity on the starving men.
Because
that's what foraging does. And think about it. Your guns will be great for protection, but don't count on them when there's everybody with guns who shot everything that's moving out there.
Matt, we're going to come back with final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Matt Stein with us. Matt, let's go to some of the calls. Chase is in Sacramento. Welcome to the program. Chase, go ahead.
Hey. So my question for your guest is this: when it comes to EMPs and solar flares, at moment of impact of these things, what all gets taken out in regards to, like, things that have their own internal batteries? We're talking like vehicles, flashlights, solar radios. What all gets taken out?
Okay, good question. I'll start with the solar storm. The solar storm is like a long, slow burn, and it does not take out your personal electronics. The problem is that it induces these massive eddy currents in the 350,000 to million volt high power, high voltage lines that connect the grid across the country, and it wipes out the transformers that step the power up and down for transmitting it over long distances. So that's the solar storm. So basically, the grid collapses, and the nuclear power plants, many of them will go into meltdown. We have 104 nuclear reactors in the United States, 442 worldwide. A significant portion of them will probably not be shut down successfully and unloaded. You can't just shut them down. You have to unload and then get them in spent fuel ponds. It's a really long, complicated, difficult process, and the chances that they're going to just be smart enough to unload everything and do the right thing is pretty slim. So you're going to see Fukushima-like events happening all around the world. Now, switch into EMP. In an EMP, there's three different effects. There's an E1, E2, E3, and each one is different. So the E1 happens in nanoseconds, which is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a blink of an eye. It's basically like speed of light and slightly slower. And what that is like opening up your digital electronics, rubbing your feet on the carpets in a cold winter's day and sticking it in and zapping a bunch of chips with sparks and saying, gee, I wonder what that did. So in actual EMP simulation tests done at the Department of Defense in big giant EMP simulators, they find that roughly 15% of the cars that are turned on and driving down the road will stop and not work. Most of the cars will actually work unless it's a super EMP-optimized device, which is something that the Soviets and the Chinese have, but is not something that an average terrorist will probably get their hands on. But they are invented and they are out there. So it's a standard nuclear device and not an EMP-optimized device we're talking about. So that's the E1 effect. And the problem is, now most of your iPhones, most of your battery-operated things that are not hooked up with large runs of wires, they're still going to work. Problem is that everything that feeds information to those things are going to be fried.
That's right.
Essentially, every complex digital control system that has significant wires connecting stuff, which means all your network cables, which means all the programmable logic controllers that run your factories and your nuclear power plants and your oil refineries and all of that stuff, the stuff that makes our world go around, the stuff that makes our telephone switching systems work, that makes our the internet work, that makes all that complicated stuff work, that's going to cook. A lot of your simple, discrete devices, they're going to be fine. So, and then there's the E2 effect. Now, the E2 effect happens in a fraction of a second to 2 seconds, and that's like 50,000 lightning strikes happening in every few miles, square miles, across the zone. And I'll tell you how big the zone is in a minute. And so many of the protective devices on our computers and stuff, our plug strips and things, most of those will be deactivated and destroyed by the E1 effect. So they'll leave our big electronics open to these huge spikes coming down in the E2 effect, like lightning strike spikes coming down the power lines. And they're going to go freely into your electronic stuff that's plugged into the grid at the time, because the devices that are designed to protect them will have been zapped by the E1 effect that happened in like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a blink of an eye. Then the E3 effect is going to happen between like a couple of seconds and 20 minutes. And that's going to be a long, slow burn that is essentially the same in a much smaller area of the solar storm effect. And the E3 effect is not going to zap your small stuff, but it's going to cause those huge eddy currents and that's going to wipe out the transformers that the entire grid is dependent upon. And so those are going to fail. So essentially, you're going to see much of your small electronics coming through fine. Many of your cars, especially if they're turned off at the time, cars are designed to have sparky EMP kind of things happening in them. They're relatively robust compared for EMP things. So many of the cars will actually be functioning, though they'll probably have small anomalies. Problem is that the entire infrastructure that depends on all this digital stuff, it's going to be screwed. It's going to be totally falling apart. It's going to fry. And that stuff means that the infrastructure collapses and the world around you collapses, even though your basic personal electronics, much of it's going to be okay. So there's a lot of misconception in that. But the stuff that really is important is going to be gone.
Tim is in Racine, Wisconsin on the Wild Card Line. Tim, always good to hear from you. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing? Great show.
Thanks, Timmy.
Pretty informative there, George.
I guess, you know, this is kind of one of those shows where you just say, why isn't anybody doing anything about this, like the government? I mean,
well, there's people trying.
But this is just, I got a question, so don't hang up. I mean, I got a comment, first of all, because, I mean, the government, I mean, they should be doing something about this, for one. Two, if something happens like that, I'm going to go to their houses, first of all, because if they didn't do nothing, we'd just take over their houses, because they'll probably be living pretty comfortable. So that's, well, if you know anybody, we should do that. But my question is, actually, what can we buy? Because not everybody has a lot of money. And if we can't forage, we don't live around them areas, what can we do? And then I guess I'll take my answer off the air, but if you could just kind of go slow so I can write these things down,
okay.
I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, first thing I'm going to say is that there's a lot of information, more than I can give right now, and it's in both my books, When Technology Fails and When Disaster Strikes, but it's totally free. There's a lot of great information on storage and on grab-and-go kits and water purification and what to do in the event of the next superbug. You know, what things you should have on hand. That's totally free at my website, whentechfails.com, and you just click on articles. So I just want to guide you there, because that'll give you a lot more information than I can give you in the next few minutes. But one of the things, you need to start small. Start thinking about your grab-and-go kit, something that you can put in your car or put on your back, and make sure you have good shoes and good backcountry equipment so that in the event that you run out of fuel and you have to move over long distances, that you can do that, you know, that you can abandon a vehicle and that you can go with stuff on your back. Make sure that, you know, have a really, really good illustrated book on foraging and on edible herbs, because it's great if you can shelter in your home and if you can use your stored supplies, but what if you have to leave that behind? You know, then you really want to be able to forage. I mean, that's a real life and death difference. And having a good illustrated book with multi-season pictures of different edible plants in different seasons of the year is critical. So have that, you know, so that can go in your go bag. Have like a colloidal silver generator so that you can make gallons of antibiotic resistant, you know, of an antiseptic solution that will kill all known pathogenic bacteria that you can, because what happens? You know, when everything goes down, there's going to be a million people peeing and pooing. Where in a city? Where are they going to go? They're going to be you're going to be drinking out of duck ponds and ditches. So think, how can I purify that duck pond and ditch water for me and my family? How can I? You know, what happens when things fall apart? Disease goes rampant. You know, people have diarrhea. It gets in the water. People are drinking the water out of the creeks. It's going through everybody. Have that colloidal silver generator. Have like a tube of grapefruit seed extract, so you can do a broadband antifungal antibacterial solution.
But this would, Matt, this would be for a few weeks to a month. If it got any longer than that, I think a lot of people are just doomed.
A lot of people are, but if you have the skill set, you don't even need to have a lot of stuff. If you have the skill set, then you can do that. You can move, because most people won't have that information. They will not be able to pick up and forage and pick up and move. And think about, you know, I mean, hopefully it's not that bad, but you don't know. So that's why I help people prepare for a variety of scenarios. And you start with a basic go bag, so you're good for 3 or 4 or 5 days in the event things are down short term. You have multiple ways of purifying water. I mean, there's the rule of threes. It says, like, well, in 3 seconds, you know, without blood flow to your brain, you start passing out. In, you know, 3 minutes without oxygen, you start passing out. In 3 hours without adequate food and, you know, without adequate shelter for your body, if it's extremely hot or extremely cold, people start getting hypothermic or hyperthermic, and they start not functioning. In 3 days without water, if you've got to be physically active and it's hot outside, 3 days people start dying without water. Believe me, it's horrible. I ran out of water climbing El Capitan in a record heat wave back in 1984, and it was horrible. And if you're in that situation, you will drink the most disgusting green scummy ditch water if that's all you have, and you won't be able to stop yourself from drinking it. So I, for one, want to be able to stick my backcountry field serviceable MSR, Katadyn, or Berkey water filter into that green ditch scummy water and get pure, clean, good-smelling, good-tasting, safe water out of that for me and my family. Have a Steripen. Steripen, it's like, you've seen the movie Men in Black? The guy pulls his pen out and says, take a look, and clicks it, and poof, you know, everybody's memory's gone. Well, you pull your Steripen out, you stick it into a quart or a liter bottle of clear water, and you give the click, and the blue light flashes, and you stir it around for 15 seconds, and poof, all of the bugs are killed and dead in that bottle of water, and it's safe to drink. You know, water is so critical to your ability to function and move. You want multiple ways of protecting and purifying that. In my book, When Technology Fails, I teach you how to do sand filters. I teach you how to do solar water disinfection. You know, things that you can do if you run out of the nifty high-tech gadgets that you can still do, like old-fashioned ways to protect yourself. There's Sari filters that they teach, S-A-R-I, in India, to help people reduce the incidence of dysentery and stomach disorders from drinking polluted water. So there's a lot of things you can do, and don't feel hopeless. You know, there's good things to do, and there's empowerment in taking action and in educating yourself and developing skills and stocking up on different stores that you can help yourself, your friends, your family, your community in the event of a medium or long term collapse of things.
Let's go to Daryl, Palmdale, California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Daryl. Thank you for calling.
Hi, George. I've been delighted to hear this topic tonight, and I look forward to getting your books there, Matt. I had a question. It was somewhat answered earlier, but in regards to, like, portable generators, I've been looking at, like, dual fuel, propane and liquid gas, gasoline. And the question I have is, when we have an EMP event, okay, that's forced on us, is that generator going to be worthless after that event, or will it still run? Is there some way that I could protect it, like make a makeshift Faraday cage or something?
Okay. You know. The chances are that if you're in the heavily affected zone and you haven't protected your generator with a Faraday cage, and it's Faraday cage is so easy to do, but if you have not got a protected backup in a Faraday cage, chances are it will be fried. When the United States did a Starfish Prime test in Johnston Island, 900 miles away, electronics is affected in Hawaii. When the Soviets did it in Kazakhstan, because it was much closer to the North Pole, they had somewhere like four to ten times the effect. The closer you are to the equator, the less of an effect you have from an EMP, because it's the interaction of the EMP with the Earth's magnetic field. So the further you are from the equator, the stronger the effect. So in Kazakhstan, when they blew off the nuclear weapon, they thought that they were well prepared for it. But it turns out that most of the generators that they had, which were pre-microelectronics, pre-digital electronics, they all failed. In fact, they had a trunk power line that supplied power to the area from a generating station 1,000 kilometers, that's 600 miles away. It was buried 2 meters in the ground. That means 6 feet under the ground. There was enough energy induced into that buried 600-mile-long line that it burned the power station down 600 miles away from the test zone. So the answer to your question is that if you don't protect stuff with a Faraday cage, there's a good chance the digital stuff in it, which most modern things rely on, will fry. They rely on it for timing. They rely on it for, you know, synchronization, stuff like that. So, you know, protecting for an EMP. Now, a solar storm is guaranteed to happen. We just don't know when. But there's a 1 in 8 chance statistically every decade for a knockout solar storm. So I don't know about you, but if somebody told me that I had a 1 in, don't worry about getting on that plane, there's only a 1 in 8 chance it's going to crash and kill you, I would not get on that plane. But what we have is a 1 in 8 chance every decade, and we've gone 9 decades now without having the killer solar storm, and we've got a 1 in 8 chance every decade of having that storm. So basically, you know, we keep rolling the dice, and we've been lucking out so far. So an EMP, well, chances are pretty good that someone will launch an EMP. Now, how big of a zone you're talking about? Small tactical nuke? You're talking like 500 miles.
And probably a rogue nation, don't you think?
Yeah, probably a rogue nation would probably have a Scud missile and a small tactical nuke. Then you're talking like 500-mile circle. Like imagine a circle that goes from like Maine to Virginia and takes out Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston, the entire, you know, northeastern major metro corridor. Now say you're talking that they got a bigger missile and they got a real-size nuke from like a failed state in the ex-Soviet Union state, and they bought it in the black market. Now you're talking like a 1,500-mile circle. You're talking the circle, I don't even remember the exact number of miles, but draw a circle on the map that goes through Quebec City, Ontario, and Miami, Florida. That includes Chicago. That includes every major city in the East Coast of the United States. That includes two-thirds of the population of the United States. And within that zone, you're going to have near instantaneous failures of a significant number of the nuclear power plants are going to go Fukushima style, and you're going to have total destruction of your power generating, your oil refining, your phone systems, your internet systems. Everything that we now use to diagnose and fix electronics is going to be fried and cooked. Everything that runs our factories, that runs our water purification, that runs our sewage treatment plants, that runs everything that makes our world go around has digital stuff, and complex digital systems will pretty much nearly 100% fail. So, you know, I mean, so your personal computer doesn't fail. Well, all the stuff you depend on for your daily life.
That does. Hey, Matt, we're almost out of time. I'd like you to get some of your websites out for us. Go ahead.
Okay, so my information-intensive website, if you go to the articles, that's whentechfails.com, whentechfails.com. Tons of great references to click through to buy books that you can add to your survival library. Great, totally free information under articles. Very information intensive. My author's website, mattstein.com, if you happen to want like an autographed copy of a book, then go there and you can get an autographed copy. You can see pictures from my personal life, stuff like that. But the information intensive is When Tech Fails, and the more personal information is on mattstein.com. And so that's really helpful. And, you know, I like to leave people with my motto. And my motto is I ask everyone to do their best to change the world and do your best to be ready for the changes in the world. And the changes are coming. You know, there's just no question in my mind that they're coming. And they're going to be hard to deal with. But the more prepared you are, the better off you're going to be to deal with these coming changes.
Okay, Matt, thank you so much for the great information. We'll always have you back on. Up next, Marshall Klarfeld joins us. His latest work, Mysteries of Alien Technology. We'll talk about the Anunnaki, Planet X. You name it, we've got it on Coast to Coast AM.